one of the questions I often get is, are you an architect or a planner? And that's like asking me if I use my left eye or my right eye. I don't understand the question.
You can probably name a few movies that center on dystopian future cities. Think The Capital and The Hunger Games or Blade Runner. But what do we do with the cities we have now, right now?
Today we have architect, planner, and author of A Country of Cities, A Manifesto for an Urban America, Vishan Chakrabarty, in the studio. He's here to talk about the future of urbanism, and we even get into why LA's mass transit system is better than San Francisco's.
Hey, I'm Asad Serket, and you're listening to The Appeal, the Curbed Podcast. While I'm usually joined by one Jeremiah Budin in the studio, today we have Curb New York News editor Zoe Rosenberg.
Hi, that's me.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. We're super excited to have you.
My pleasure.
We're just going to take it away.
Sure, yeah. So you have your hands in a lot of things. You're an associate professor at Columbia, which we were just talking about. You founded PAU recently. And you've done a whole lot of other things, including writing a book, which is highly praised. So when you are filling out your tax returns, what do you tell the IRS you do?
I just say architect, and I pretty much stick to that. If I have more words, it's architect, professor, sometimes author. But I usually just stick with architect.
Do all of those things fit in the little field, in the little box on your tax form? You
have to My last abbreviate? Name doesn't fit in the box in the tax form.
I feel you. So that's the least of your concerns.
Yeah, that's the least of my concerns.
Yeah.
Architect usually fits.
I mean, so just for people who don't know, Zoe mentioned PAU, the Partnership for Architecture and Urbanism. You recently founded the firm. Tell us about that venture. Why did you decide to found this firm specifically?
Well, so, you know, we're actually about to celebrate our 6-month anniversary. And by the way, you should feel free to call it POW.
POW,
which
all
is
right.
What we
I like that. That sounds great. Aggressive.
Exactly. In fact, we're having a little open house to celebrate 6 months. It's going to be called Boom Boom POW. and we have like a powwow section on our website.
No, of course.
I wanted to start a firm that was specifically about a dedication to the advancement of cities in terms of both architecture and urban planning. Architecture that was more civic architecture and really engaged. You know, it's interesting. I've done a lot in my career with like the verticality of cities. And I think a lot of our work right now is more about cities as a horizontal plane, what you experience on the sidewalk, the first few floors. The most interesting thing to me about this endeavor so far is if you look on our website, there are really no images. There's, you know, a couple of news clippings and things like that, but we don't have any work up on our website. What we do have up is a mission statement that basically says this, that we're a firm dedicated to the advancement of cities, and goes on to talk about what we do and more specifically what we don't do, which apparently has caught a lot of people's eye and interest. But I think it's important. I think as architects, as professionals, we should, and not in a self-righteous way, just put a stake in the ground about the things that we do, what we want to do, the things that we do well versus the things that we don't want to do. And I think that there is a sea change going on in this profession right now. We went through this era through the 90s of sort of what I like to call more is more, right?
Where, yes, that was definitely the mantra of the 90s.
Right. And then, you know, this millennium hit and it hit us with a bang between, you know, the recession, 9/11, basically a lot of the issues that we see around climate change. I think we realized as a profession that just building grandiose architecture for very wealthy patrons really shouldn't be our primary role as designers. It's certainly not what I wanted to do with a firm. And so both in terms of work and in terms of young people who want to come work for us, they seem to be very inspired by that mission. So we have clients coming to us who are very interested in social impact and very brilliant young designers who are coming to us also interested in social impact, which has been great.
Yeah. So that mission statement that you were just talking about lays out a pretty specific vision for what you would like to see moving forward. So what do you think is an ideal city?
I don't know that I mean, certainly one that is more inclusive, more cultural, more public. But I don't know that there's any one ideal city. Mm-hmm. I mean, because cities are about people and people are about culture, and culture varies from place to place with geography and topography and just everything in terms of how we use land as people. And so I don't think there's one ideal city. What I do think, though, is that cities sit at the epicenter of what I perceive as three forces that are going through geometric change right now. Climate change, I think, is accelerating at a rate that none of us fully understand. And it's both frightening, but also a call to arms.
Absolutely.
I think social inequity and the levels of social inequity we're seeing are all, it's also happening at a geometric rate. And I think particularly as it pertains to race and the geography of race in our country and other countries, I think we're seeing a huge new awareness, but also a very drastic shift in just basic social mobility metrics that are extremely important. And then the third thing that's progressing again at a kind of geometric rate is technology. And what's so interesting to me about that is, again, like, you know, I always say to my friend, like, try getting an Uber in a cornfield. It's impossible. Right. It's fully reliant on density. Mm-hmm. And so to me, all three of those huge forces that we need to sort of grapple with, think about, all swirl around the space of the city. And so that's what really interests me in terms of what a practice can do, both in terms of architecture and larger scale planning, is I am actually naive enough to believe that a piece of architecture can impact those things. And
we're so glad that you're out there. You people with such hope and optimism.
Right? I am optimistic, despite the fact that those are all really tough. I mean, technology is something I think to both be optimistic and pessimistic about. Yeah. But the other two, you know, climate change and social inequity, are really tough issues.
And when you're talking of issues of race and gender and how cities reinforce those hierarchies and those inequities, those are really complicated, knotty subjects that take a lot of smart brains like yours to help kind of untie and unfurl for people.
And I think it's critical that we, you know, admitting the problem is the first step, that there's geography and territory associated with these issues. You know, where Eric Garner was killed in Staten Island. I mean, it's interesting. Northern Staten Island, urban renewal cut the highway through the middle of Staten Island, Staten Island Expressway, that for years was referred to as the Mason-Dixon Line.
Wow. Mm. Right? I did not know that.
Right. And so, I mean, just think about that for a second, right? That, like, that here in the city of New York, one of our boroughs, I don't know that it's true anymore, but for years, this highway was called, like, was literally given this title that's totally associated with racial segregation. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can't ignore that this stuff is territorial, and therefore how we think about cities has to address that.
Yeah, I think that sort of segregation is something that I know we've seen traditionally through New York, especially with like the Robert Moses era. I think the Cross Bronx Expressway was...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I feel like when people think about cities and development in general, I think often gentrification and real estate speculation become parts of the conversation because they're things that we talk about so much as journalists, as the design journalists, but also as people who live in New York. What are ways to develop cities and to progress past kind of improvisation? Not that improvisation in cities is a bad thing at all, but what are ways to develop a city and sidestep kind of the uglier sides of that development?
Well, I mean, you know, I as I look at, because we're doing work nationally and we're doing some work on the West Coast, and it's very interesting. In my mind, there's sort of two sets of cities out there. There are the really successful and therefore gentrifying cities like New York, San Francisco, Boston, you know, and then they're, you know, very expensive, have huge affordability issues, huge segregation issues. And then there are the Detroits and the Newarks and the Baltimores that are struggling, but at the same time, and somehow, in some ways, feel sort of more authentic and less homogenized than a lot of the cities that are quote unquote successful. And so I think in the big economic driver cities like New York and San Francisco, we really have to think about the land that's left out there and how to better build that land so it is not just about gentrification. Mm-hmm. And this is a very tough issue. You know, this is a market-driven economy, and I believe in the free market. But at the same time, I think there are things, there are projects we have in our office right now that I can't say a great deal about, but where we are exploring, you know, I think of design in a very broad way. And I think as designers, we can design buildings, and we can design public spaces, mm-hmm. and we can do industrial design. But I also believe that policy is a form of design. You know, I used mm-hmm. to work for Mayor Bloomberg, and we did the rezoning around the High Line, and that was a piece of design. It was about thinking about the city in a different way. And I think we need to think about zoning, economic issues, ownership structures, for instance. Are there alternative ownership structures out there in cities in a new shared economy mm-hmm. that could help stem some gentrification? I believe that there are.
What do those structures look like, just out of curiosity?
Well, we're very interested in our office, and we did some teaching about this at Columbia about community land trusts mm-hmm. and different ways in which, basically, how, you know, if redevelopment occurs and land prices start going up, can existing communities get a piece of that? Can it help stabilize an existing community? So not just saying no to new growth or new development, but saying, well, that should be part of what helps everyone in this community, not force some people mm-hmm. out while others get to stay or newcomers get to right, stay.
Which is so often the case.
Which mm-hmm. is usually the case. And I think that, what everyone, I think, needs to understand about this also is that this caught all of us in this profession by surprise, the force of this. You know, after 9/11, when I worked for the city, the last thing in the world we were worried about is overdevelopment and gentrification. We were worried about whether any new development would even occur in our major cities. People were so fearful of more terrorist acts. And so, a lot of the policy that took hold throughout the 2000s was really to make sure cities kept growing. And it was very hard to predict at that point that there was going to be this perfect storm that led to a huge amount of urban growth and therefore gentrification. And so now I think we're all taking a breath and mm-hmm. saying, look, it's time to create some more balance here in how our cities grow.
Yeah. New York sort of reached that tipping point. As the editor of the New York side, I see these projects that people have been working towards for a long time that are for a certain mm-hmm. very high, very far off population having the plug pulled on them. So a couple condo developments that are for, quote unquote, the millionaires and billionaires that are not moving forward. So what really, where do you see urbanism going as of this moment, maybe particularly in New York and beyond?
So I would like to think that we and some other firms are a little bit on the tip of the spear on this issue, where people are coming to us, and I don't mean just us, I mean firms that are also share our values, if you will, and are asking questions about, again, how to develop cities differently. And I think we've seen a big progressive movement emerge out of some recent mayoral elections. And obviously, if you...
Maybe, like, some recent ones.
Right, some recent ones. But also, if you see... I take both the Bernie Sanders movement and the Donald Trump movement very seriously. And both of them, in my mind, speak to a level of sort of disenfranchisement that people are feeling in the country. And
rightly or wrongly.
Rightly or wrongly. And in different ways. And in some cases, in overlapping mm-hmm. ways. I mean, I think I find it fascinating that there are people who would vote for one or the other, right? Because they actually see this sort of common thread between the two. I mean, I think that's fascinating. And I think it, again, speaks to a level of disenfranchisement and a level of deindustrialization that's happened in our cities. Not every city is New York or San Francisco. There are cities that were filled with manufacturing jobs that no longer have those mm-hmm. jobs. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, this is the way in which urbanism is moving. That, it's not just about your next luxury residential development. I think the way in which we work in the future in cities is changing dramatically because of technology. That might have something to do not even so much with redevelopment, but preservation of old building stock. Mm-hmm. And so I think these are some of the things we really need to think about moving forward in tandem with affordable housing and parks and schools and all the stuff that's sort of planning 101. Mm-hmm. I think the landscape of the profession is changing very drastically.
Absolutely. I live in a part of Brooklyn that's incredibly car-centric, much to my frustration. It's in Crown Heights. Are you in Brooklyn or are you in Manhattan?
No, I'm in Manhattan, but I was just out in Crown Heights just a few weeks ago.
Well,
yes.
I hope you liked the neighborhood.
It's a beautiful neighborhood.
I love it. Where I am, though, is just there's like a... just so many drive-through fast food places, which is just, it boggles the mind that these are part of the urban fabric in incredibly dense Brooklyn and in New York City in general, that you would have like a drive-through Wendy's next to a drive-through McDonald's. I mean, it's very intense. But I find that there are some kind of empty lots where storage units are being built that it just strikes me that these would be the perfect place to put affordable housing, to put public parks for people to actually be able to use some of these spaces and to create more street, you know, street life and just to have, as Jane Jacobs says, like eyes on the street, especially at night. Mm-hmm. What do you think some of the boundaries are? I mean, obviously zoning, if things are zoned commercial, like the zoning just has to change for there to be affordable housing kind of developed on those sites. But what do you think some of the other boundaries are there?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by boundaries, but...
Yeah, I mean, I guess just in changing zoning, like and just... flat out, you know, to changing how those things are zoned. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that zoning for that type of commercial property is a bit different. And I'm not an expert, but I'm sure you can explain better.
Well, so, you know, we're seeing this play out with the de Blasio administration's efforts around the rezoning in East New York, which, you know, passed. And I think they are going to create a significant amount of affordable housing there. And they're trying to focus more housing in areas that do have good transit. Crown Heights has pretty good transit. Mm-hmm. But I actually think this issue is broader than affordable housing because I think the affordability question is broader than just housing, right? It is, where do you go to work? How do you get your kid to school? How do you get fresh food? All of those things that tie in and sort of constitute a person's life. And I believe we are, like if you look at our transit system or most transit systems around the country, they're built around a hub and spoke model where everyone was supposed to come into a central business district, like what you see on Mad Men, right? And I think that's changing drastically. Like my office is in the Flatiron. It's extraordinary watching the numbers of people who walk to work in the Flatiron or in Dumbo or what will happen at Domino. And I believe that it's even a tougher thing because it's more than just zoning. It's going to require tax incentives and a bunch of things. But we should be thinking about, as architects and planners, how to create more spaces for people to walk to work. And be able to walk to their local school and walk to get groceries. And part of what that means is how do you develop new places for, like, say, small technology companies or incubators to grow in a neighborhood like Crown Heights? So it's affordable not just because the housing is affordable, but because I can live there and work there. And yes, I can still go to Manhattan every 6 months or every few months to see a show or something, but I'm not dependent on getting on mass transit every day to go to work. Right. And, you know, this Barcelona, 30% of people in Barcelona walk to work. Well, they're trying to up that number to 50%.
Wow. Ambitious.
Right? And it's possible if you have the right mix of uses, which goes back to zoning and tax incentives, but also very much to architecture, because you have to design the space that can accommodate that range of uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because the hub and spoke model, as you called it, is sort of falling apart. Yeah, a couple weeks ago, and I'm sure you saw this, somebody tweeted that the San Francisco's Bay Area Rapid Transit System was just completely over capacity. How exactly did that go down?
And they it was like a tweet rant from BART. They basically just were like, "Don't give us grief about this. We're trying our best, but like this system was built, you know, in a time when there just weren't as many people using it, and so they were really upfront about how the fact that they just don't have the infrastructure they need and the people they would need to really get this thing running.
Incredible amounts of people are relying on it every day.
It's I went to Berkeley for my architecture degree, and I never. Think like sitting here now 20 years later to imagine that Los Angeles would have a better mass transit system than San Francisco.
Is that true?
Absolutely. The subway system they're building in LA is extraordinary.
And tell us more.
Yeah, that's kind of, it's kind of incredible to hear.
It's modern and it's safe and it's clean and people are using it. There's an article about it in the Times travel section this week about how you can now go to LA and visit without a car.
Didn't the line between San Francisco or Santa Monica and downtown just open or something?
It either just opened or is about to open. I can't remember which. I haven't been there in a while, but I know that it's like well underway.
Mm. Yeah, that is incredible.
This is two mayoral administrations that have been fighting for this. And, to me, how do you find optimism? And you find it in, like, we just opened the number 7 line extension here. And yeah, it leaks a little bit and they'll fix that. But like...
You're being very...
Right.
You're being very... Yeah, it leaks a little bit.
Well, I mean...
It's
a whole other topic why our infrastructure is both so expensive to build and so subpar.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back to talk about that because I'm very curious.
It's a whole other topic. But look... hope springs eternal. There are places where we're doing smart things. But I actually don't think the future is going to be so much about building lots and lots of new subway lines because it's just very expensive. Mm-hmm. And but if we look at, a place like Domino, where there's going to be both workspace and living space and a school mm-hmm. and park.
And so for listeners who don't know, when you say Domino, you're referring to?
The Domino Sugar Refinery in the Williamsburg waterfront. It's just places like that to me are much more about the future because not everyone wants to be in a glassy skyscraper in Midtown. Some people do, some people always will, and that's great. Right. God bless. But I open an office, I walk to work, and we like to open our windows when it's hot.
That sounds great.
It's really nice. Yeah, right. Totally. And we like to go to the farmer's market in Union Square and go get a margarita after work. And like all of those things we can do with mm-hmm. no problem where we are. And that's really important. It really speaks to quality of life.
Sure. Yeah. And for those who haven't seen the Domino Sugar Refinery project, it is the future. You look at those buildings and it is the future. They are unlike anything you've ever seen.
Yeah, it's going to be impressive. I'm interested to see how it fills out, like how people kind of begin to make use of the space and mm-hmm. and form it into, what it will end up being. Because I think, there is planners and architects can do a lot and we applaud you for your efforts. But people really do have to swoop in and make the best use of the space that they can. And
absolutely.
Improvisation, which I mentioned earlier, happens. And that is always great and really works in tandem with what has been planned. Mm-hmm. I'm super excited about that too.
Well, I'm a big believer in what I like to call discursive public space, which is this idea that public space isn't just this place where you go to eat your lunch on a sunny day, right? But, it's where protests happen and it's where serendipity happens. It's where you run into people and run into ideas. And I think that is really fundamental to how a good city works and how innovation occurs.
Mm, absolutely. Well, that's a great moment to segue into our thunder round.
Thunder round.
Which we call it that. And I will not give you the full explanation for why we call it that, but it's a bit slower than a lightning round is all I will say.
Yes.
So we call it a thunder round. So people think about Blade Runner when they think about kind of like futuristic cities, like the kind of landmark futuristic cities.
In movies
specifically. Is there a future city in a movie that you are particularly fond of or that you think about when you're working?
Oh boy.
Take your time. Bashan has his eyes closed. He's thinking hard.
A future city. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could also be like a Star Wars style, like in the...
Oh, that's very generous of you. I'm just going to step in with my thought.
Please.
Yeah. I am particularly fond of the city, the depiction of the city in Super Mario Brothers.
Which I have not seen.
It is so bleak and dark and dingy and moist, which is the perfect word for it.
Oh, God.
It is a sad depiction.
But what do you like about that? What is so intriguing about that for you?
You know, I don't know. I think it endeared itself to me when I saw the movie like 15 years ago.
Right. But this is actually why I'm struggling with this question. I mean, usually Hollywood depicts future cities in really bleak ways, mm-hmm. right? I mean, and Blade Runner, which is, you know, look, it's visually fantastic, but it also, you know, there are these really odd racial undertones to Blade Runner that, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't look out,
they're not that far under the surface.
Yeah,
either.
Right. I mean, that if you don't look out, our city's going to become like an Asian city and it's going to be really scary. And I had a professor who once said to me that that the world of Stepford Wives looked much more dystopian to her than Blade Runner ever did.
150%.
Right.
That is so true.
And so it's really hard. You know, it's interesting. There are very few movies that are like sort of optimistic about the future. And I can understand why. There's, like I said at the outset, there's a lot of tough problems we're facing. But as a consequence, you don't get a lot of images of the city in the future that's positive. And, you know, this to me ties back to sort of the earlier question you were asking about, well, when we were talking about urban renewal and Bob Moses. See, one of the questions I get asked a lot.
Bob. Yeah, you're on a first, right. on a first nickname thing. Basis with a Robert Moses. Bob. But please, well, go on.
We call her Jane Jacobs. Why can't we call her Jane all the time?
Yeah.
One of the questions I often get is, are you an architect or a planner? And that's like asking me if I use my left eye or my right eye. I don't understand the question.
Exactly.
And it's because if you look at the history of the profession, after World War II, there were all, Team 10, you know, groups like the Smithsons, Aldo Van Eyck, there are all sorts of people who worked across the scales from architecture to city planning seamlessly and had a very humanitarian vision for our cities. And in those people's work, you actually saw incredibly optimistic ideas for the future city. Right. And I really think urban renewal did a real number on us in terms of this. It decimated our ability to plan cities well or plan cities at all. And I think it gave people a very sort of tough taste in their mouth about what the future city could look like.
And so as a result, film depictions of these places, I mean, they generally
garbage.
Are bleak. Yeah. All right. Well, that's homework for you then.
Okay.
Find a movie about a future city that is like a nexus of optimism, please do email me. I would be very curious about that.
That's a good point. So here's a real hard-hitting question. We're New Yorkers here. How do you take your bagel?
Ooh. Mm-hmm. I used to live down the street from Essa Bagel.
Ooh.
And the only way for me to eat a bagel is like a plain hot, you never toast a bagel. You can't toast a bagel.
I agree, but I know that that's just a controversial position to take. Zoe is giving a skeptical.
Listen, I'm a scooper.
A real bagel cannot be toasted.
Fair.
Right?
So just a plain,
hot plain
brand
bagel.
New, fresh out the oven.
Absolutely. I mean, I can do a schmear.
Huh? All right.
But, you know, just plain cream cheese. I mean, nothing crazy.
Yeah, what do you mean you're a scooper?
I'm a modernist, you know.
Yeah.
Do you know about this phenomenon, scooping bagels?
But yeah, apparently I'm just blowing everyone away. I mean, I love bagels. I love bread. But I love my bagels scooped, which is you take out all the bread and you put stuff in it. You put schmear in it. You put some onions on it or whatever you put on your thing. It's just a lot, you know.
And you toast it before you do the scooping?
Oh, no, there's no toasting. No, I'm camp no toast.
I think as long as you don't toast your bagel, Vishon is fine. Sipping water.
I've never heard about scooping.
Really?
Right? No.
I had heard of scooping, but I'm just not on the scooping train.
That's fine.
It just sounds like that thing that Domino's does when they stuff the cheese in the crust.
Oh my God, you're ruining it for me.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Thank you for doing that.
Sure. My pleasure.
So another question for you as someone who lives in a city. What is the shortest distance you'll ride in a cab?
Ooh. I would say, oh yeah, because I've done it. The my kid's school's very close to our apartment. It's maybe like a 7-minute walk. But if we're super late and it's like raining or something, so right. that's like...
No, that's legit. And yeah. now that
that's
you've,
like 4 blocks.
You mentioned a child. We can't be right. mad at you about that.
That's like 4 blocks or something. Yeah,
but that's fair.
Child yeah. adds 4 minutes.
Right.
At least.
And then the
but
bad
I always,
weather.
But I always feel guilty. I mean, that's always... That's just not really very cool. My wife does it more than I do.
Mm. All right, well...
Throw her under the bus.
Yeah, exactly. Put all the blame on her. Well, she's not here to defend herself, so too
that's
bad.
That's what marriage is for.
Yeah. Well, I think we have time for about one more question. Yeah, yeah. So this is our culminating episode of our first season. And in this time, we've come across a couple guests who have very strong opinions about words that may or may not be applied to their title or profession. For instance, curator is a word that, or curate is a word that mm-hmm. people rally against. And also the word honest when applied to architecture.
Like honest materials.
Yes, honest materials.
Ooh,
yeah.
So
there we go.
Yeah. So other than that, are there any words that you just don't like?
Network is a noun.
Preach.
It is a noun. Look, I'm an author, right? And I have an absolute love for the English language. And I just feel like not only does it generally get slaughtered all the time, but it, like, did Donald Trump really just say bigly? Like, did someone just say bigly?
But, exactly.
Right, exactly. But architects, man, can they do a number on language. Like, it just... Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's the other one. Architect is not a verb. You cannot architect something.
Oh,
it's called designing.
Wait,
something.
Say
you've never
yeah,
heard
people
this?
Say that.
No, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You will hear people say that. You'll hear
for...
people say that.
That's grim.
It is really rough.
I've looked for synonyms for designs for design for 2 years now, and I will never use architect.
Yeah.
I promise.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we can put those in our
log,
ever increasing list of words to not misuse. Because, yeah, that's never use architect as a verb. Please, people.
Right. And network is a noun.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah. My pleasure. Has been really fun, and we hope to see you again soon.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks
so
much.
There's a movie I'm thinking of now. I'm going to email it to you.
All right.
I'm going to find it.
Yeah. Because we can always, in the post about the episode, we can always like link to the movie or something.
Yeah. I was thinking AI had a... depiction
which I
of a
seen.
City.
That's Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, I think it was also Sneaky Bleak. Elysian is not.
Yes.
Elysian also Sneaky Bleak.
Right, and the thing about Elysian is that it.
Oh yeah.
Elysium, it provides
is it
like I think it's Elysium, but it provides this model for like a beautiful, well-functioning city that kind of has glossed over all of its like racial and.
Well, it just leaves all the racial.
Just like
stuff.
All of the discrimination, it has glossed over those things in favor of presenting this like. Ideal city facade, but really it's like a space colony, and then there's peril
and
on Earth. So
who
that didn't really work out well.
Lives on Earth.
I think right. I'm thinking of is it's a little different because I'm not sure it's really like I don't know that it shows the city that much. Maybe in a couple of shots, is the Martian is weirdly optimistic about the future.
I didn't see that one.
I did see the Martian, but
like
tell
hear.
Me more.
Yeah.
Well, it's just, you know, like everyone rallies to save this guy, right? And like the U.S. and the Chinese get together and there are some shots of like the future city. Right? Mm. There are also actually in the Star Trek movies, they show San Francisco in a pretty nice light.
Aww. Star Trek was always the place for optimism about urbanism.
About modernism and technology.
Yeah, totally, totally.
So that's what I'm going to go with. I'm going to go with Star Trek movies.
The mics are still live.
But,
so.
Yeah, we're
but, that one and like, I check out The Martian. I think there's some optimistic scenes in there about cities.
Yeah. I mean, I've been a Star Trek fan since I was like 6. I've loved Star Trek my entire life. And I think that was part of the appeal was this like multicultural, even if it was like a bit pandery, it's like, you know, you've got like Whoopi Goldberg as like the saucy ship. You've never seen it.
So I have. It's been
you know,
many
but, you know,
years.
It is so telling that you say you've watched Star Trek since you were 6 and you make the Whoopi Goldberg reference. That gives
I
away
know,
our age difference
I know, but
in like the worst kind of way.
Right? Like, yeah, but
like,
I know the classics.
Whoopi
too.
Goldberg was not on the Star Trek I watched when I was 6. I will tell you
or
that
even
much.
Uhura. Uhura. I mean, you know, she was the original. So, okay, so on... on Star Trek, on the original series with Captain Kirk, which I'm
William
sure...
William Shatner.
Yeah, William Shatner. Yeah.
Yes, Captain Kirk. Familiar.
That was the first interracial kiss ever aired on American television.
That's true.
It was between him and a black woman who was... I don't remember what her, like, position was on the ship, but she was, like, a ranking officer.
She was
the
communications ship. Officer.
There we go.
There we go.
And she was gorgeous and smart and sexy and just, like, so... Such a different thing to see on television. It was really amazing. My mom and dad are the two that got me into Star Trek.
So there we go.
That show was always optimistic about the future.
It was.
Like, we figured it all out as a race.
And... Yeah. And then we went, like... out into the stars and still maintained like a sense of decorum and like, I don't know, politeness.
Yeah, and not to attack
about it.
Things.
Right.
Right? Just, but to just explore.
Like if only humans were that way.
Right. Cordial, you know? And honest.
Cordial and honest.
To use a word. In a different context.
Yeah. Honest in this context is fine.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you again. This has been really,
thank
really
you so
great.
Much.
It was fun.
Yeah. That's the last episode of season one of The Appeal, the Curbed podcast.
Just like Game of Thrones, it was a 10-episode season, and we hope that you listened to every episode, but if you didn't, they're not sequential, so you can just go back and listen to all them now on iTunes, on SoundCloud, and please rate us.
Mic drop.